This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Karen, Heather P., and Margot. Thanks, guys. You can become a Blotter Presents tipster your own self at patreon.com/blotterpresents. And now, the episode.
I think the question most people ask, that they know I'm a person of faith, and they said, how could there be a God when 13 were killed, so many were injured? And I said, if there's not, those bombs would have went off in the building, and there would have been 600 to 700 people who would have died that day. But I really felt that there are things that can't be explained.
A graduate of Columbine High School contemplates the emotional journey she and her classmates have been on ever since April 20th, 1999 in We Are Columbine. A history podcast contemplates the now nearly forgotten tale of the kidnapping of Adolf Kors III in a 2018 episode of Most Notorious. While you, dear listener, contemplate how many classless Rocky Mountain Low puns I auditioned, then rejected for this intro to the podcast about two Colorado crime stories, I'll just go ahead and fire myself. But no worries, Toby Ball can take over for The Blotter Presents, episode 93. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast examining the idea that while crime is bad, some of the stories about crime can be pretty good. And welcome back to near-permaguest Toby Ball. Hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Hope you enjoy your new crime podcast since I fired myself.
That's right. It's just going to be an hour-long stream of consciousness.
I think that the listeners are here for it. let's find out. Let's get into it with our most wanted entry today, which is a new documentary, We Are Columbine. It is available on iTunes and video on demand as of this recording. Here is the case file. I really can't believe that it's been 20 years, but on April 20th, 1999, Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold killed 13 and wounded 24 others in a shooting rampage at Columbine High School, at the time the worst school shooting on American soil. Nearly two decades later, Columbine graduate Laura Farber talks to a few of her classmates, plus the principal and a freshman English teacher, about that fateful day and all the days since in We Are Columbine. I will place a trigger warning here. The film is not concerned with the massacre itself. In fact, the PR rep asked, you know, this isn't really a true crime story. So are you sure you want to review this? And I said I did. But if you have been in similar situations, some of this material can be a little raw. So just be aware, given that that's the topic. And if you need to skip this section, we will talk to you on the flip. So Toby, generally, how did you find this documentary?
You know, it's tough going. It's very, you know, it's about trauma, basically. It's about yeah, a traumatic event in these people's lives that happened, you know, 20 years ago, and sort of their experience when it was happening, and then, you know, trying to get past it, or not even getting past it, that's not even the right word, but trying to kind of deal with it in their lives as they go forward. So I could see why. I mean, it really isn't true crime, but I think it is, like, again, like when we watched The Sentence, which was,
yeah,
another,
that's what I was thinking, yeah, about also, our conversation about that, that sometimes, you know, these documents about the spaces between are just as important and well done as, you know, a more straight ahead thing that we might traditionally think of as true crime. But anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
It's right. So when people, I mean, I think a common criticism of true crime stuff is that the victim or victims kind of get lost as, you know, you take a look at the perpetrator and, you know, the crime and the investigation, all this stuff. In this, you know, it's all about, you know, the victims. You don't even hear the names of the two gunmen. So
yeah, you really don't. And I think that there's not even. I could be wrong about this because I did a little Googling around just to refresh myself on some timeline stuff. And I'm not sure you even see them.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's none of, like, all the footage that they show, I think, is basically people, like, running out of the building. So they're sort of reinforcing the story that these different people are telling about what happened to them during that period of time when they were at Columbine High School and sort of locked in a room or running across the street or whatever. And that's kind of reinforced with this footage showing kids leaving the school.
Yeah, but they're definitely, it's not the footage that we've seen a million times of people being hoisted out a window.
No.
The gunman sort of pacing around that you see in the security camera. This is just like pretty much these kids who I think were all in the class of 02 at Columbine High.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
And then their
teacher, Mr. Leyba, who I believe was a new teacher like that year and was like sort of bonded to this particular class. So he's also in it.
Yeah. And you know, the whole thing starts with, you know, these various people saying to the filmmaker, you know, essentially the only reason why I'm doing this is because it's you and I know you'll, you know, do this responsibly. And I think part of the deal was this is about the survivors, not about the perpetrators.
Yeah. Which is fine. I remember reading in a couple of places that one of the students who died that day, there were a couple of memorials that were groups of 15 things, like flags at half mast or crosses placed in a nearby park. And the father of one of the victims would always go to these places and cut down two. Because that number included the killers.
Huh.
And this guy would, like, someone put 15 crosses in a park across the street, and this guy was like, nope, and, like, went out with an axe and kind of cut them down, which...
Wow.
But there was a lot of... there was a lot about this that I didn't remember, because I feel like when it happened, this was not a story that... that I was like following or sort of watching unfold as it happened. I listened to Dave Cullen's Columbine, the audiobook on a road trip, and I thought it was great. But at the time, there was a lot that I didn't remember, and there were some... I thought that sort of tied in an interesting way to what this film is saying, whether it's trying to or not, about the way that memory works.
Yep.
And the way that we use it to process trauma. I had thought that the We Are Columbine sort of, not catchphrase, but the cheer was from after the massacre, but actually it was from before. I do have a clip, and then I had another thought about that.
Okay.
Here's clip two.
We were getting ready to play a football game against one of our rivals, Pomona High School, and he came up to me and said, I want to try something to motivate the team. And so that's when I heard We Are Columbine for the first time. It was right around 1989. So when I became principal in 1996, I said, boy, what a neat rally cry for our school.
I believe that's Mr. Moore, who is a coach, and one of the students, his name is Zach, and he's now a teacher and a coach at the high school, talks about how this guy would, like, lose his voice doing this chant at pep rallies, and people were, like, really into it, and the school administration really, like, seemed to care about them, and Mr. D was always talking about how he loved these students, each and every one of them. And I remember...
You accidentally summoned me.
No, I didn't accidentally summon you, Siri. Why do you always do this during the Blotter Presents? Mind your own business. Excuse me. Nice. So I was thinking about how I totally just lost my train of thought. Oh, yeah, that's right. I was not aware. You know, they have talking head interviews, and then they're edited in quite seamlessly, just like braided in with the students walking through the school and going to the places where they were that day and demonstrating, like, Amy gets under a table in the cafeteria to, or the commons or wherever they were, to demonstrate what she was doing that day. And I thought that this high school had been torn down, but it wasn't. They dealt with it as a crime scene. And then the next fall they went back to the building and it's still operating.
Yeah, and I think Zach goes to the room where he was, and he's like, oh, my God, like, nothing has changed. It's exactly the same. Yeah, you know, so my experience is...
I think I was thinking of Newtown.
Yeah, that could be.
That they, I mean, some of these schools, they just can't. Right. And they have to tear it down, and I, you know, especially when it's... Well, I don't know what the thinking is in either direction, but... They didn't seem to think that that was, no one voiced thinking that that was inappropriate. I was just sort of surprised that he's like, oh yeah, nothing's changed. I'm like, but it's a totally different room, but it wasn't. So that was a part of my memory that wasn't accurate. Anyway, what were you going to say?
Well, just my experience, you know, I was teaching high school when this happened.
Oh my God. I didn't know that.
Which was which led to some interesting conversations when you're teaching, you know, high school social studies.
Yeah.
And something like this goes on. And, you know, so a lot of my memories of it are kind of tied up with various things that people kind of brought up as being ways to mitigate what people saw as some of the issues that led to, you know, the Columbine incident.
You're saying.
So,
were you kind of in a, like, not therapist position, but I mean, were you hearing a lot from administration, like, you know, keep an eye out for such and so, and these are some students that we're concerned about? Is that what you're talking about?
No, well, so there's a couple different things happened. One was that, there was a kid who scrawled a death threat in a bathroom, and, you know, I believe, as I remember, school was let out. Anyway, he was caught, and he was like, you know, the New Hampshire State Police caught him, and it was all on camera on the news of this kid.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was pretty nuts. But the other thing was, to a certain extent, it was the kids, but it wasn't, you know, my memory of it, at least, was not that the kids weren't like, they were concerned about it, but I don't think they necessarily connected with the point that they felt sort of unsafe. I feel like they felt that it was, you know, far enough away and, you know, so different from what their experience was in like a small town in New Hampshire.
Right.
So, but there was quite a bit of conversation about, like, there's a lot of talk then about, like, what do you do to kind of try and get rid of some of these issues that people were throwing out there immediately, you know, the trench coat mafia or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, so one of the things was, you know, metal detectors at schools. Mm. And, you know, there was, you know, all because, oh, it's so stupid, Mr. Ball. But then the other one that got sort of more of a conversation was the idea of school uniforms and that they would break down the differences between the students, so that you wouldn't have like an in-group and an out-group. And I actually, God, I got into this awful, like, sort of tense conversation at a party with these two moms who were like totally giving me the business about it. And I think the whole thing was that it was what they basically wanted to do was have everybody dress like the popular kids, you know, like the wealthier
right.
kids. So it was like khakis and button downs, like everybody. And I'm like, well, the kids who, you know, you're just making the kids who are disenfranchised, you know, even more resentful because they can't wear the clothes they want to. They have to look like the assholes, right. You know? And so that, you know, there's just all this stuff that was kind of going on, and being a teacher and being a young teacher, you know, it was kind of a lot to take in and try and reconcile, like, these ideas that people are coming up with and talking about versus, like, who you're actually in the classroom with, and, like, how is that going to, like, trying to envision how that would work with the population of students that you're teaching, and how that's gonna, that would change things. So that was one thing. And are we going to talk about pep rallies later, or is this the time to do it?
I hadn't planned to, so let's do it now.
Well, I was just, you know, and again, I don't...
I mean, and I went to a girls' school, so a lot of this stuff is, like, not...
Right.
Not something that, like, including, you know, boy rage was not something that I was experiencing.
You know, this is kind of a side thing, or I don't know if it's exactly meta, but I thought it was interesting that so, like, they concentrate, really the one thing you get out of their school is these pep rallies, right? With this, like, guy going berserk and people, like, chanting. And again, I was just thinking about in-groups and out-groups and, you know, in like these sort of, you know, out-group sort of, you know, really kind of iconic things. Like, I was thinking of Nirvana's Smells Like Teen Spirit video and Heather's, where pep rallies are seen as sort of this really divisive thing that they're shown as being sort of grotesque for people who are not sort of in the in group.
And there are always, like, these visual references to, like, Riefenstahl.
Yeah.
Like, that they want to be very overt. And then that, you know, the killers in this case were listening to a lot of troublesome German music anyway.
Yeah. So that, you know, that was a weird, like, again, it's clearly not a main point of the movie, which I think is important, and I think is about a lot of different things. But that one part of it, I was watching and I was like, "Hey, you know."
Well,
I think this is pretty revealing in some ways.
Yeah, let's talk about the selection of the interviewees, because I think that the I mean, they're not kids anymore, but the people who were kids then, the selection is, you know, these were her friends is A, and these are people who agreed to participate is B, but three of the four were very sportsy and were, like, they were the in group, I would say. Like, granted, when this occurred, they were freshmen, and, you know, who knows how everything settled out differently after that, but, like, you have a cheerleader and the captain of the girls' basketball team and the, you know, did soccer and football, and these were, I think, kids who had, you know, Zach, who is now a soccer coach, describes himself as, like, an anxious kid and he hitting his growth spurt and all of this stuff, like, standard feelings for a 14 or 15 year old. But, like, when you're on the sports teams, it's just different. And then the fourth kid was a, like, just stoner, but seemed to also have a, like, a social group. And I thought that these people were well selected in terms of their ability to, like, give good talking head.
Yep.
Like, it was all good tape, as our colleague Rebecca likes to say. But it's also, like, I'm, you know, this is an interesting cross section that is not actually that much of a cross section in terms of what I would suspect was the social strata of the freshman class.
Right.
At that time. With that said, it's still very effective. And I will say, I kept making notes of things they would say that, like, being five blocks away and, you know, on 9/11 is not really analogous, except that it's a, you know, these were both terrorist events. I'm not sure what other similarity, like I was 27 years old. It's different, but the way that they would describe what they were thinking at the time and how that day is never all that far away from them, and like other ways that they would recollect it was interesting, to me. Like, I'm not going to be like, oh, I'm a survivor of 9/11. Like, that's a little much.
Right.
Like, I was five blocks away. But the way that they recapture this for the camera did feel very familiar. This next clip is Amy again talking about that like mental mode that you're in during something like this, where you're like, is this a capital T thing yet? Like, how am I supposed to be right now? So there's clip three. Here's clip three.
But I don't think anyone like really understood exactly what was happening. Like, kind of like, whoa, what the fuck? And are we gonna be, I almost want to say like in trouble or something for like all of us just running. Like, are we making a big deal out of nothing?
Yeah, that's kind of how, like, that's kind of how, like, between the first tower coming down and the second one, we're all like, so is this a thing?
Right.
Like, is someone going to come and tell us that this is officially a thing? And then eventually someone did. And then Zach, I think, wound up asking some teacher if, like, do we have to go back to class? Am I going to get in trouble for going to my house? Like, I think it was a very surreal experience for them. And the way that she described it, I was like, yeah, that's exactly what it was like. Like, is this a drill? I don't even know what's going on.
Right. And then there's this sort of feeling like you don't want to be, like, you don't want to be stand out as, like, the person who panicked over nothing.
Yeah, yeah, especially in high school,
right,
where you're like, am I going to be the drama queen or king?
So if I run down the hall in hysterics and out the door, is everybody going to be like, what the hell's wrong with that person?
Yeah, and then cut to 3 years later in your, you know, in the yearbook, where like that's what everyone remembers
for.
It's the person who freaked out about nothing. Like, it definitely wasn't. But another clip that struck me was Gus, the stoner kid, talking about how they're all like hunkered down in this classroom trying to figure out what to do, and the fire alarm just is still going, because of course it is. And that was totally my experience on 9/11, that we're all in the Bank of America and people are like, is someone going to shut that shit off? Like, this is not helping. Anyway, here's clip four.
It was just us watching the clock, and on top of that, we have the fire alarm going the entire time. It's obnoxious for a reason. I mean, it's a get the hell out of here type of noise. It's not a, you know, it's not something that you're going to go to sleep to. So there's still a lot of activity going on. And, you know, we're just thinking, like, at what point do we get out of here? At what point do we do something? Like, why don't we just make a run for it?
So, yeah, I feel like I don't think I would, if, like, I had this to do again in terms of picking who was interviewed, I don't think I would do it any different, because I think the movie is very affecting and really well done, and these interviewees really get at, really sort of put me there, you know, in terms of what it was like to be there. But it is interesting that this is who was picked, and this is who agreed, you know, however reluctantly, to do it.
Right. And three of them, like, get into situations where they're helping people in some way. And then the last guy, Gus, I guess is a hip-hop artist.
I guess that's a helping profession.
I guess. If you have a broad definition fan of the word help. I think it was, you know, I thought it was good. And God. I mean, it does. I mean, it's a tough watch in a lot of ways. And there's also, you kind of have a sense that you're like watching in some ways, like sort of snooping on a, you know, a therapy group in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's there. If I think in other hands, it might have felt more intrusive than it does in this. And maybe it's just because they're friends. And I think it's similar to The Sentence again, in that because you have somebody who's close to the people who are on camera, that it feels less intrusive or exploitive or whatever, and feels more like something where the people who are being interviewed are really sort of participants and like almost colleagues with the person who's making the film. Like they're sort of doing it together, which I think is a nice
feeling.
Yeah,
there's one moment where Amy is talking about how she always knows where the exits are, and she's like, I could leave right now, like I know how to get out of this room and go out the back door. And there's a pause, and then off camera you hear, I assume, the director say, please don't.
Right.
And then Amy's she sort of laughs, but you could tell that she's like, but I could.
Right.
And I might.
Right.
There was something very just relatable about that. And I thought it was smart to open with all of them kind of talking about, like, you know, this is not my favorite. And then they sort of circle back to that later when they're talking about what it was like to, I forget the exact name of the school that they ended up going back to finish that
right
semester. Chatfield, I'm going to say.
Sounds right.
It'll be in the visual aids, which you can find on social media. That's at Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. Because I cut a picture of the sign that said, you know, we stand with you. I think it was Chatfield. But Jamie, the basketball captain, was talking about, you know, they went back to playing sports, and the jerseys had their school name on it, and that people are always like, what they say, what they don't say, what they ask you, what you can tell they want to ask you. I think that probably never stopped for years and years. So it was really something. I thought this was well done. And I thought that this was also an illustration of, you know, I think some people complain about documentaries that they're not objective, or that the filmmakers have an agenda. Like you tend to hear this about Making a Murderer.
Right.
Generally speaking, I feel that this is a complaint that is only raised when the agenda is not shared by the viewer. See also people complaining about Michael Moore not like providing a transcript of like Flint financial hearings. Like he's not claiming to be an arbiter.
Right.
He's a filmmaker and a shit stirrer. Whatever else you think about him, I don't think he's claiming to be completely objective. But this is one of those projects that I think really make the case for not being objective and making this very personal, specific document about everything, about the, this is an unfortunate term, but forgive me, the sort of blast radius around an event like this. I mean, it's not fun, but it's one of those Dear Zachary projects that I'm like, this is an outstanding, you know, document in the sense that it stands out, but recommending it is not exactly something that I can do because it's roof stoof. It's hard to sit through.
Although I think ultimately in some ways it's kind of uplifting in that, you know, these are people, I mean, they, you know, obviously there's trauma and damage and all this stuff, but for the most part, they seem to have lives, you know? I mean, it seems like they've been able to move forward with their lives, even if they haven't been able to, like, leave this behind. You know, stable relationships and, you know, careers and...
yeah, and I think that's a good...
genuinely sort of optimistic people, I think.
Yeah, I think that's also a good... I'm not sure that that's something that the film is explicitly trying to message, so to say, but I think it's also something that's worth taking away from it, which is, you know, trauma happens and, like, grief happens, and it, you know, closure is something for the... for fiction, but it's possible to, you know, it's possible to sort of survive or endure or whatever verb you want to use an event like this, but also that, like, it can walk with you and not ruin your life, basically.
Right.
This, 'cause that seemed to be what they were doing. And, yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's not like horribly bleak. Like Dear Zachary is another matter, but yeah, I agree with you. I did have some other clips, but I'm just going to skip to the last one, just to sort of put one more point on how smart these interviewees are about talking about this event very personally and then making it more universal and recognizable to the audience. So here's clip 7, and I think this is the English teacher, Mr. Leyba. Could be the principal.
People, they think that there's these concentric circles of trauma. So if you're at, you know, ground zero of the event, that you're more screwed up. And if you were further away from that, you know, if you were in another room and you were locked in, you were probably not as damaged. And if you were on the other side of the building and you didn't hear or see anything, you were probably okay. And if you were outside at lunch, you were fine. It didn't matter where people were, necessarily what they saw.
Yeah, this was very striking. This was another quote about this sort of event that was very striking to me, just because, as far as 9/11 is concerned, I've always been not glad, but it was better for me to have just been right there and seen everything.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think some people I knew who were at more of a remove from it struggled more to get their heads around it.
Yep.
I was present, helpfully went into, like, emotional shock for 2 days so that I could deal, and that ended up being, I mean, it was not a fun time in my life, but I think being present was better for my particular neuroses than not having been there. So, yeah. So this is We Are Columbine. It's on iTunes. It's on video on demand. It is directed by Laura Farber, and it's pretty great. Pretty, you know, harsh, but pretty great. I recommend it.
Yeah, it's not like a date movie,
no.
But I think you've got to be, like, prepared for it and sort of in the right frame of mind. But it is good. It is good, and I think it's definitely worthwhile watching.
Yeah, and I don't think that there is anything. I mean, other people's triggers are not my department, of course. As far as the actual massacre, as we've said, you're really not going to be interacting with that, but the, you know, sort of watching these now adults reprocessing that day might ping some things for people that aren't comfortable, so
right.
Just be aware. But I found that not soothing, but it was powerful for me in a good way. So
yeah, it's about as far from exploitive, I think, as you can get.
Yeah,
with this kind of material. So
yeah, I think this is Laura Farber's first foray into anything like this, and she should continue doing it. I think.
Yeah,
because this was good. I was not as big a fan of our cold case.
Oh, good God.
I'm sorry. Okay, so, you know, I sometimes try to force a topical theme on episodes, as I have done here. Lesson learned. Today we're contemplating an episode of Most Notorious, which is a podcast from April of last year. We will link it in the show notes. This concerns the kidnapping of Coors Brewery heir Adolf Coors III. Generally speaking, this podcast interviews like true crime and history authors about famous crimes or their work. For example, I believe Rachel McCarthy James was on it a couple months ago to talk about The Man from the Train, which she co-wrote with Bill James. I am going to listen to that episode because I love their work, but I am not sure that this kind of podcast works for this material. We'll get into more specifics in a sec, but first, the case file. On the morning of February 9th, 1960, Adolf Coors III, known as Ad, disappeared on his way to work. When a ransom note showed up the next day, the FBI took over the case, and Ad's disappearance became the biggest kidnapping headline since the Lindbergh case. It did not end any better than that case did, and last year, the Most Notorious podcast did an episode on Philip Jett's book on the kidnapping, The Death of an Heir. Here's the thing. It's not that this podcast is bad or necessarily boring. Perhaps it's just this guy's, Philip Jett's, delivery. I found it very difficult to get and stay focused on what I was hearing. Did you have this problem?
I did. Yeah, I mean, he seems like a very nice guy, but he also, he really loves his material, and B, he has some kind of like strikingly strange takes on things. So the combination of those two things, where do I begin? I don't know. There was just like weird stuff. Like he'll say things like, "Oh, and they were really fortunate in that he was shot like twice in the shoulder blade, so they were able to, like, that's not like really fitting in with my idea of what's fortunate." You know, I mean, he kept saying. I think he must have said like two or three things because it stuck out to me, and I made a note of the final one where he said it because he kept saying, "Well, it was fortunate that you know, the blood spatters were able to, I mean, he didn't exactly say that, but it was like all these, like, it was horrible enough that there was enough evidence that they could figure something out was essentially what he kept saying was fortunate. And I was like, I don't know, man. I'm not sure if I buy that. And there's some other stuff. He does a like fairly long description of what Reader's Digest is. Do you remember that? He like starts.
I forgot about that until just now because he would start. Here's the basic setup of the podcast. It's definitely one of those podcasts where the host is like, "Here's, you know, my guest today is X, who wrote a book on Y. It's called Z. What made you want to write this book?" And then, you know, authors have been waiting for someone to ask about their book that sold 571 copies. 4 years. They have worked really hard on it, and they don't, like, this is not NPR. They can just talk for 5 minutes, and that's what he does. And that's the format of the podcast, and I'm not clocking it. Like, it really just depends on your guest. And Philip Jett is not, like, he's not boring, and he doesn't say a lot. Like, there's a little bit of, like, throat clearing and verbal tics, but I just have a feeling that this particular case, which at the end of the day was fairly straightforward, does not fit all that well with this format of conversation podcast, which is like the host Eric Ravenis, I'm not sure how you pronounce his last name, forgive me, Eric R, he'll just be like, "So tell me a little bit more about X." And then it's 6 minutes of this guy who has been marinating in this topic for years now talking. And it's, you know, it's not that this is not a significant case. It is interesting that this guy heard about it on a brewery tour in Golden, Colorado, and was like, how did nobody write up this case when it was such a huge deal in the history of the FBI? But there was just something about, like, maybe there weren't enough questions. Maybe the host wasn't breaking in often enough. Like, there's good material here. I just felt like this was, at 75 minutes, it was probably about 55 minutes too long for me. I did have to keep rewinding because I just kept, not dozing off, but just I'd like be on Twitter and realize 10 minutes had gone by and I had not been paying attention.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where the problem is. Could be just me.
Well, I was starting to think about, you know, the format, and then I was... Did you listen to that podcast? I guess it was like Reply All or Code Break or something like that, where it was, they did a one-off episode where they interviewed a guy who wrote a book about this South African guy who became like this internet, like Moriarty, where he was, you know, basically facilitating wow. like opioid sales in the US through the mail by using these pharmacies, and then like expanded from there to like doing gun running in Africa and like smuggling meth out of North Korea, and like basically had this like worldwide sort of criminal web. And Jesus. But it was the exact same format. It was like a guy interviewing another guy who wrote a book about a criminal. And but the whole time you're like, what? And part of it's the story, like the story he was telling was outrageous and just insane. But it was also, I think it was just faster. You know, I mean, I kind of felt like while this guy Jet like kind of goes on at length about things sometimes, like it would have been a little more helpful, I think, if the interviewer had sort of had like 20 questions or something, and like really like structured the interview so that it was like, you know, you've got 3 minutes to answer this question, you know, what about this? And then when he's done with that, just, you know, on to the next thing, so that you're kind of building the story along rather than sort of asking these like fairly open-ended questions and just letting him kind of ramble. And part of it is that it was hard to keep, like, there were times, like, by the time you find out that, like, I listened to this in faith, so I was, like, listening to it doing one thing, and then I went up to pick up my daughter from school, and I was listening to it, and I was driving along, I was like, wait, have I found out if this guy survived yet? Like, did he live or did he die? And, but it seemed like we'd already kind of gone past that, and then they go back to the fact that no, he was killed, and then you find out later that he was killed like almost immediately. So the whole thing, it didn't really cohere as a narrative. I mean, it was more like two guys sitting down talking about a book that some guy wrote, but it didn't seem like there was really like having an audience in mind who wanted to hear a narrative that made some kind of sense that would kind of, you know, you could kind of follow along to. I mean, it just seemed like a semi-structured conversation and not a whole lot different than like if you just sat down with a guy and had some beers and was just like, hey man, tell me about your book.
Which is like, you know, and some people are into that, and this would be like, this would be maybe a good bedtime podcast because it is like a lot of history and like mid-century cases and Victorian cases, and this is definitely something that like it was like I was not able to focus on it, so it's not going to keep me up. That sounded so shady. I think this podcast is actually good. Here's the thing. I'm not sure that Philip Jett has written anything else, and I failed to look that up before we started recording, so who's the asshole now? But I think this is maybe... I talk often about like, especially in more or like higher brow true crime that's like trying to get filed in the history section instead of in the back of the Barnes and Noble with all the books with black covers with red writing, that these authors will leave all their research in because they, you know, drove to this teeny little town in the middle of nowhere and went through the records with a dust mask on, and God damn it, it's all going in. And that isn't always, the narrative is not always served by that. In this case, I think that they needed to, and this is not this podcast's mandate, but as you were talking, I was thinking, what would Phoebe Judge have done with this story? Because you have a bunch of different stories that, like, you need to take a slice and just not, don't tell the whole story chronologically. Like, take a slice out and give us, like, the cross section. There's that term again. Of one of the issues that makes this crime compelling. Like, where was the FBI when it came to domestic kidnapping cases in 1960 versus in the early 30s? When it was just, like, it wasn't even called the FBI yet.
Right.
J. Edgar Hoover was around, but, you know, already you were having jurisdictional battles and stuff like that. Like, that's interesting. You also have the fact that Adolph Kors Jr. called Hoover, like, at home and was like, you gotta find my kid. Here's clip 8.
Within the first 2 days, the FBI took over the investigation and assigned a lot of men to it because Adolph Kors Jr., the father of the Adolph Kors III, called J. Edgar Hoover personally and said, hey, you guys have got to find my son. So, you know, most of us can't do that. And J. Edgar Hoover, you know, number one, it was an important family. And number two, J. Edgar Hoover always wanted good publicity for the FBI. And so he jumped on it and, you know, made it one of his personal, it was the biggest case domestically for J. Edgar Hoover. And at that time, this was before Patty Hearst and, you know, some others. At that time, it was became the second largest kidnapping case in U.S. history, behind the kidnapping of Lindbergh's baby.
Right. Well, and as so often happens in these cases, like, the kidnapping actually was almost immediately a murder or a manslaughter, and then everything sort of unraveled from there. So you have that slice of it. And then you have the fact that the kidnapper, they sort of talk about how he's an interesting figure and he was tested with this high IQ. And he was in jail for something else. And, like, they kept sending him to progressively less secure facilities. And finally he ends up, like, at a camp, basically, that doesn't have guards. And then he just leaves. Like, Chino, back in the day, right, was like Camp Minnehaha. And if he didn't fit, like, it, you know, he smuggled himself out in some laundry.
So,
and went to Colorado and assumed a new identity. And then went to, like, and then this happened. And he's, like, just being an idiot. Like, he's sort of trying to get caught. I mean, I have a clip about that, but it's like, okay, maybe, you know, if Phoebe Judge were telling this story, she would focus on that point in the manhunt at which Joe Corbett, the kidnapper, obviously wants to get caught. And it's the moment at which he rents a very bright red convertible and uses a check with his name on it.
Right.
And then it's 22 minutes and it's much more produced, and she can sort of edit Jet down to the, you know, down to the studs, I guess. And again, he's not that rambly. I mean, compared to me, he's a model of concision. I'm just saying.
Yeah, it's just not, it's not like, it's not a particularly exciting story. Like, it might be interesting. I had two thoughts while I was listening to this, and one was, you know, and it wasn't as, you know, well thought through as what you just said, but one of them was, you know, it might be good to have a third person in there. So there's more of a conversation than just an interview. And the other thing is, like, it would have been awesome if he had some, like, point of view, like the interviewer had a point of view or some kind of take that would direct the conversation to be more than just sort of a synopsis of the book. And the, you know, and this is not, I do not mean this as like a self plug or whatever, but when I was doing Radio Free Dystopia, we read this this great book called a Kim Jong Il production. Have you read that?
No, I've heard of it though.
It's awesome. It's by Paul. Oh God, hold on. Let me look this up real quick because people like this book. Why am I making this so hard on myself? Paul Fisher. We had him on. I think it may have been the only author interview we did. But our whole take was like looking at North Korea as a, you know, a dystopian society, and how did, you know, film play into that and art in a dystopian society and stuff. So it ended up being a really cool conversation because rather than just having him like how I wrote the book and, you know, this and that and the other thing, it was like, let's talk about your book from a certain viewpoint. And, you know, it kind of allowed him to like go outside just like the contents of the book. He's a very smart guy and made some interesting observations about stuff. So I thought that was a really good segment. It was a lot shorter than an hour and a quarter, but I was kind of wishing that there was something more than just tell me about it, you know, that there was some kind of pushback on some of this stuff, like, you know,
or make it more, I mean, to your point about like having another host, maybe to just like be a little bit more of a foil. You could also have a number of other authors on and just be like, how has, how has like the crime of kidnapping evolved from like at the time of the Lindbergh kidnapping? And the host brings this up explicitly and Jet addresses it in the last clip. This was a quick money maker for a lot of people, which almost never resulted in a death. Like it was the Depression. There were no jobs.
Right.
If you wanted to make some money, you had to kidnap a rich person and or their family members. So if you had like, oh my God, why can't I remember this guy's name? I'm going to say Falzini, who works at the New Jersey State Police Archives and has put together a couple of books about, they're like sort of coffee table books about the evidence in the Lindbergh case.
Oh.
And then you could have Tubin, who wrote the Patty Hearst book. And then you could have this guy. Because, this was a BFD, this kidnapping, and then it kind of sank below the horizon for decades, but it's just a little bit too, like, the format is not serving the story well, and it's also not serving Philip Jett very well, because I think he's, you know, he's a coherent guy. He did do all this research and he does have that, you know, chewy accent. He's enjoyable to listen to, like, orally. But this just was like, there wasn't enough, like, there's just not enough going on, like, not to be all like, you know, MTV style editing ruined my attention span, although that may be true. There just needed to be a little more like terrain in the audio.
Yeah.
Something.
Well, there's remarkably little back and forth.
Yeah.
You know, it's really question, answer, question, answer, question, answer, like maybe a follow up.
And when he does get to something like he'll get to a sort of interesting point that I'm like, that's the point where I would be like, well, I'm so glad you brought that up because I was thinking da 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 and what about this? And then the host is not, the host does not necessarily do that. Anyway, let me play this last clip.
And it goes to what you were talking about as well. There was a lot of kidnapping going on in that time. That was a big business. Of course, today, I find it, it has to be near impossible to kidnap someone in the U.S. successfully to, and get a ransom. It happens in many other countries, and U.S., you know, employees, executives of U.S. companies are often kidnapped in other countries, but not here, not with the FBI and not with the technology we have today. I just can't imagine. It's easy to grab someone. I say this all the time. The easy part is grabbing someone. You can grab anybody at some point if you plan it well enough. The difficult part is trading that person for money. That's where it gets more difficult.
I mean, yeah. So tell me more about that.
Yeah.
I just kind of, you know, I prepped this and then I was watching a Bosch screener and they have these characters talking about how many dumb shit criminals catch themselves on social media. And I was like, that's the kind of thing that I wanted from this. Like, that's right. The kind of information that I wanted from this, because this Joe Corbett guy did the like Darwin Award finalist equivalent of like being on Instagram with yeah. with a stolen car or whatever. Like, no. And Jet makes the observation, like, it's like he wanted to get caught. Like, all right, maybe that's the way in, and this can be 25 minutes instead of 75, and you just slice off a little bit of the story so that it's not quite such a like long listicle. Whatever the opposite of a listicle is, a macro list.
Popsicle. I don't know.
Popsicle. Yeah. I mean, I watch a lot of PBS and a lot of American Experience, and I can go stuffy grandpa content, but there's just something about this one that it's not working, and it's too bad. It's too bad.
Yeah. I mean, I would almost, again, I don't want to lay it on the author's doorstep, but
me neither.
I might listen to another one just to see like something that was more, I was sort of scrolling through the topics. And there are a couple that kind of caught my eye as being, oh, you know, this looks pretty interesting. So I might give it another listen just to see like if the dynamic was a little different.
It could depend on, I mean, it could depend on the guest. It could depend on whether, like, I haven't read this book. I did find a excerpt from it from Long Reads, and that'll be in the show notes. It's a bit, he's doing that thing where he's like basically speculating as to what happened, and he's giving characters dialogue even though they're not characters. No. And it's a little it's a little a lot, I guess, for lack of a better term. But it, like, it's fine, but it's also like, it's not a book I read and it's not a story I knew, and maybe this podcast is not for people who didn't read the book. I don't know.
And I think that the other thing is, I think there's a reason why you don't know the story, which is, the story isn't really that mind blowing. You know, he tried to kidnap the guy. The guy fought back. He killed him by accident. Still wanted the money. Feared it wasn't worth it. And then that was kind of the end.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's Joe Corbett's. Like, Joe Corbett, and there's also a whole podcast episode to be done, someone steal this idea, on dudes whose last name is Corbett figuring in these, like, key moments in American history. Like, isn't the guy who they think was the one who shot John Wilkes Booth, that guy's name was, like, Boston Corbett, I'm pretty sure.
Was it?
Yes.
I have no idea.
I mean,
I was thinking of Gentleman Jim Corbett.
I told you I could go deep with this grandpa history shit, and I just proved it.
So there's that. Olga Corbett.
Olga Corbett. Yes. No skater and assassin. Don't yeah. have me.
Gentleman Jim Corbett.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go back and listen to the episode about the man on the train. And there's a couple other that couple others I saw on the list.
Like he's got like a thousand reviews on iTunes. And I think it's like a 5-star average. So like he definitely has an audience.
Yeah, but I think that now that I know what it is, which is basically like book talk with, you know, true crime historians and authors, then I just was expecting something that had a little more like variation in, like I thought there would be more narrative versus monologue, and now that I know that's what it is, then I can adjust my expectations accordingly. But unfortunately, I can't recommend this episode for whatever reason. Format, topic, guest, host. It's just like, it's a long 75, and I can't recommend it. But listeners, if you have heard other episodes of this and you can point me and Toby in the right direction for in the archives, please do. That's at Blotter Presents on Facebook and Twitter. Speaking of letting us know, Toby Ball, where else can listeners find you?
Well, I'm on Crime Writers
and sometimes
On.
Sometimes me.
Yeah, I'm on Crime Writers On, which drops on Mondays. I also host the Deep Dive Book Club podcast, which is on the Crime Writers On Patreon. That Sarah's been on quite a few times and will be on the next one that gets put up, which is on Fatal Vision by Joel McInnes. And we had a great talk with Alex Segura and Julia Henderson, who is behind the Bikram podcast.
Oh my gosh, I think I didn't put that together until you introduced her while we were recording, and I had to just like quietly fangirl like on a post-it to myself.
Yeah, that was an awesome podcast, and she's very good.
She's great.
And, you know, hopefully before the next time I am on the blotter, my sort of long gestating UFO podcast will come out. But you can follow me at TobyBallNH on Twitter for more info on when that finally drops.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
It had been like almost 3 months.
Is that true?
I know. The roof Jeez. Is getting lonely.
I know.
Oh, man.
I know. Well, we jumped right back into it.
Yeah. Well, sorry that second thing didn't work out, but hey, even Ted Williams only batted 406. All right. Coming up on The Blotter Presents in a couple weeks, Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Jed Lund. That is the latest Ted Bundy scripted project from Joe Berlinger. In the meantime, something else will happen, probably involving a new podcast, possibly one by Paul Holes, but I haven't scheduled it yet, and I honestly can't say. Here's what I can say. If you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, please find me on social media. Like I said, Blotter Presents on both Facebook and Twitter. You can become an official Blotter tipster at The Blotter's Patreon page. That's patreon.com/blotterpresents. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on iTunes so other people can find me. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell a soul. My guest has been Toby Ball, and he's on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.